Hi, everybody. Can you hear me? Is the sound good? Good. Well, you know, it's no secret that we all have secrets. The thing is that some secrets are healthy and just perfectly okay, and some are not. And they're very nasty, and they're very negative, and they will destroy you and your sobriety. So let's move on. I'd like somebody to pick out the secret keeper in that photograph. Memorize the faces, because we're coming back to this. All right? The actual reason I put that up there is that I have no idea if they are or not. They're just four good-looking people. But that's one of the things about secret keepers. They look like everybody else. So what's our structure today? Well, it's pretty simple. What, why, and how? I call this business of keeping secrets in an addictive sort of way, in a way that undermines our self, undermines our sobriety, undermines our relationships with people, undermines our relationship with the higher power. I call that secret keeping. So we'll look at some characteristics of that. Look at some ways that people develop secret lives and stay stuck. And then how, some tips, tools, and techniques that will improve your recovery. So the basic principle, if you one takeaway today, you have two right there on the screen. Secrets sabotage your sobriety. Who'd like to define sabotage for me? Anybody? What does it mean to sabotage?
Destroy.
Destroy, yes.
Undermine.
Undermine. Ruin. Yeah, and we've all heard this one, right? The corollary, you are as sick as your secrets. Yes, everybody's heard that?
Yes.
Good, okay. So we're going to talk a little bit about a splintered mindset which develops. Now let's anchor this in the big book. I'm going to read this word for word. On page 73 of the big book, it says, more than most people, the alcoholic leads a double life. He is very much the actor. To the outer world, he presents his stage character. This is the one he likes his fellows to see. He wants to enjoy a certain reputation, but knows in his heart he doesn't deserve it. The inconsistency is made worse by the things he does on his spree. He trembles to think someone might have observed him. As fast as he can, he pushes these memories far inside himself. This is the key. He is under constant fear and tension, and that makes for more addiction, more drinking, more drugging. That's from the big book that we all look to. I have interpreted it this way for what I call the secret-keeping trap, okay? And you can see some of the things I've highlighted there. Double life, the actor, the outer world, the stage character. You know the root word for personality? We all say that people have a good personality or they don't have such a, right? We use that term all the time. Well, the key word there is persona. And persona is the Greek word, the ancient Greek word, for mask. And so it was a theater term that they used. So the person playing the emperor would wear the mask of the emperor, and these were big masks. And the beggar and the princess and, all these different characters had a different mask or a persona. And so the stage character, we have the certain reputation there that isn't deserved. There's inconsistency. Inside he trembles, worried that people have observed them. The basic sense there is most people who are secret keepers, and I don't know how many are in this audience or if there are any, do things when no one is looking that they would be ashamed of or if that would ruin their reputation. And it's deep inside us, and there's constant fear and more drinking. So a dual personality develops. requires living two lives. This wall can be conscious or unconscious. Everybody know the story of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde? Anybody? It's a story that was written in the mid-1800s by Robert Louis Stevenson, the person who also wrote Treasure Island. And it's about a very well-meaning doctor in England who tries to help people. That's his only mission, and his name is Dr. Jekyll. But at night, in order to make sure that he gets a potion just right that will help people, he drinks a potion that he makes in his laboratory, and he turns into this ugly, hideous Mr. Hyde. There you go. That's a little look at an old-fashioned look there. This Dr. Jekyll on the right, and that's Hyde on the upper left. And he goes out, and he does all kinds of crimes, all kinds of criminals, comes back to the same house, and the potion wears off, and Dr. Jekyll wakes up himself. And he leads a good life, and then he drinks the potion again, and he turns into Mr. Hyde. So this idea of a split personality or dual personalities, double lives, is very common, actually. The essence that Robert Louis Stevenson said in his book is, man is not truly one, but truly two. There's two of us. The part we show to the public, the part we show to everyone outside us. And then there's the other us that's inside us, the self. And it may not be the same at all. Basically, it means living a harmful double life. So now we have a very positive look here at this phenomenon with these characters from comic books and movies. Look at this. They're dashing heroes with double identities. Everybody must remember Clark Kent, and he turns into Superman by going into a closet and comes out Superman. And we've seen this over and over again. And there's Wonder Woman. The key is that their secret lives are far more exciting than their humdrum daily lives. And we have this imprinted in our psyche. Now, let's take a look at some secret keepers in the news. I'm not going to hang along on this, but we have a man who has 30 years of child pornography. We have smokers who cover up and do smoke secretly. And we have this. This is a quote from 1993. This is a newspaper clipping. And, of course, we've all seen how there's this shadow world in the Catholic Church. We see it played out all the time in the news, who got caught and who, how many people were abused and so on. There was a time, probably back before 1980, when nobody knew this. It was there, but nobody knew it. And of course, what's happened since? Well, the Archbishop and so on of our St. Paul Diocese, I'm not picking on Catholics now, please, but the Archdiocese did everything they could to cover this up, transfer the priests to new parishes, and so on, but they didn't address the victims. This is an interesting clipping. Our famous aviator from Minnesota, Charles Lindbergh, had a secret family in Germany. There are his three children. And this got exposed through DNA testing back in August of 2003. So, who knew, huh? Who knew? Kirby Puckett. There's a newspaper clipping here from 2002. A woman says that she was his mistress for 18 years. The title there says, The Secret Life of Kirby Puckett. And then there's this kind of situation, a professor at the university here had over 42,000 pictures, images, no, excuse me, 4,200 images in his university email account. It says each week. So obviously he had a persona that that people admired because he was a professor and told all kinds of interesting information to his students and whatnot, but secretly he was doing this stuff. So, a splintered mindset. It demands high levels of calculation. You don't want to get caught. You're living in these two worlds. You could be smiling like this to the people that you're public, and that could be your employer, your employees, your co-workers. And duck away into the men's room, the ladies' room, snort some cocaine, come right back out, and there you are again. But you had to do that in secret, hoping you would never get caught. Just one example. So here's the thing about it. It's seeking an external solution to an internal dilemma. What does the 12-step program say about that? Anybody? It doesn't work. What is used to replace it? God. Yeah. In other words, it's time to live one life, no matter whether we're on our own and no one is looking, or when we're in public. And the source, and this is hammered home strongly in the chapter We Agnostics, there's pages and pages about how God is available for those who seek God, and that becomes an internal solution to an internal dilemma, which changes our behavior on the outside. So, how many of you agree with this? Something outside me used to be able to can fix what's wrong or missing inside me. Very common idea. Hands? Anybody get to that? Okay, good. Now, there's something going on here, though. When you go out and do these behaviors that we're going to look at in a little bit of more detail, when you look at these behaviors, I'll tell you one example. There was a man who was a civil servant in St. Paul, and he had a very respectable job, high position. At lunch, he would put on a mask, he would put on a wig, and he would go to a casino and bet, and nobody could recognize him because of this disguise, and then come back and go to work. Well, what's going on here? He was excited. He was breaking some rules he shouldn't have. It was a pleasure while he was there to indulge. Maybe it wasn't about the winning at all. Maybe it was just about fooling people. Then he got back to the office, took off his disguise, didn't get caught, fooled him this time. There was risk. That means adrenaline and dopamine was pouring through his system. And then he was proud that he maintained a record of never being caught. So let's look at some dangers of living this way. First of all, we all have this duality. We all have it. And the good news is there are secrets that are perfectly okay to have. We'll look at those in a sec. It can take many forms of behavior. Most of us are here for alcohol or drugs, but it can take gambling, eating, sex, internet, shopping, shoplifting. Duality can lead to painful consequences and emotions. If caught, there's the loss of reputation, which, of course, impacts your outer persona, your social standing. The man who got caught putting on the disguise and coming back after lunch and resuming his work, he got fired. His name was spread all over the papers. His family, I'm sure, just went, like this. They just cringed. So there was shame, guilt, and embarrassment to him, and surprises, shock, and dismay to others. Duality feeds secret-keeping and requires hiding, cover-ups, deceptions, alibis, lying. That's a lot. Is that what a person in recovery should be doing? Does that describe a person in recovery? Somebody who lies, deceives, covers up, has alibis? No. That doesn't describe us. So, can you pick out the secret keeper? Well, here's some ways you can identify. Actually, here's some trouble about identifying, and here's what makes it difficult. The general population is very seldom suspicious. Secret keepers pride themselves on being clever and always make sure that they have left no clues or hard evidence. They cultivate an above suspicion image. When and if hard evidence appears when they're caught, then all the dots connect. There was a story about maybe 20 years ago. We lived on a street, and two blocks down, we've discovered that somebody was arrested. The police showed up and they arrested this person. Of course, the question is why was he being arrested? Well, in those days, he had a whole huge stash of pornography. So, people could say, oh, yeah, that's right. I was a little wondering about him. I never could, right? You know, the dots now connect. When we're using as alcoholics and addicts, we can become extremely accomplished. So I'll give you an example of my life. So I was, first of all, I gave up marijuana back in California. That was every time I've quit something that's addictive, it's been its own story. So the first one was tobacco. I had to stop cigarettes. That took months. Let's just say I managed to do it. That was 40 years ago. Then came marijuana. I'd been smoking marijuana for 11 years. It became clear to me that I couldn't keep doing this. And I didn't have the 12 steps. I didn't have the big book. But I prayed to my higher power at that time. And I said, Lord, you got to help me in this. Because it's ruining so many things. My health, my connection with people, my connection with you. So I made the decision to stop. And again, it was another 6 month, 1 year process of saying no to begin with, and then ultimately saying yes to the life of freedom that I had gained. Now, I continued to drink. Up until you heard that I have 20 years of sobriety as of last week. Up until the day before I stopped, and of course I remember every detail of that. One, I had liquor in my car, in the trunk. I had ice cubes, replenished ice cubes. I had mix. I had cups from Super America so that I could pour a drink going home. And then if somebody saw me drinking as I was driving, they would just see the Super America cup. So I was deceiving. It was a secret. Nobody knew. My dear wife, who's over here, didn't know. There were times when we would go out to a party and have wine for dinner and so on. And everybody, at that point, for the normal drinkers, that was the end of their drinking. Well, that was just the start for me. Whenever I had, let's say, a Saturday all to myself, or even better, a weekend, I knew I could, like it says there, go on a spree and, you know, then somehow pull my act together for Monday morning when I went to work. Another thing I did, I had 4 or 5 different liquor stores where I lived, and I would make sure that I went to this one and then not go to that one until I'd been to those other 3 or 4, right? And then come back, and then the clerk is going, oh, it's nice to see you again. And I'm going, yeah, it is. And they were thinking, of course, that I had finished. You know, after a while, they get to know you. You're a customer. Now, get this. So they had a little secret ritual around that. When I was a counselor, I heard of somebody who rigged his... Are you going to be ready for this? You've probably heard of it. He, in his car, you know, the squirter that squirts the windshield. Well, he rerouted it to a tube inside the dashboard. And so he would squirt and then, you know, suck on the tube. There you go. Simple. Who would have ever thought, huh? And it's this kind of thing over and over and over and over again that secret keepers are known for. I'm glad I got a good little chuckle there. So, you're the detective. How do you detect somebody who's been doing these rituals for years? Years. So I walk around, I show up at home after driving home from work, and Susie doesn't even know that I've had two drinks already. Then, let's have a drink. Okay, that's now my third drink. Have you also noticed this about alcoholics? The morning after, somebody will say, how much did you drink last night? And just two. And of course, two 16-ounce drinks. So they just because if they could get it in a bigger container, that's all the better, because then they can just say they had two. All these kind of gimmicks and tricks, very deceptive. Now, let's look at this thing down here at the bottom called impression management. There, that's impression management. And we all do this. We all do this. We all print before the mirror. We all put ourselves together so we look good to people on the outside. We may be feeling crappy and on the inside, it doesn't matter. We look good on the outside. And the idea is to manipulate other people's impressions and to your benefit by calculated techniques such as innuendo, ambiguity, half-truth, and what the author of this book, Irving Goffman, says are crucial admissions. Obviously, I omitted telling my wife about all the things I just told you because that would have blown my cover. This is a great book for you guys. I've got several others here I'm going to show you today. It's called The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. And if you want a fun read, this guy is a professor and scientist. And what he has done is he's taken the study of this to the extreme. Very, very simply, and there's many examples of it. Think of a store. Let's say Target. Okay, so when you walk in to a Target, you see all the shelves full, and you see people moving around, and the cashier selling. And that's the front, considered the front of the business. You walk through the doors that say employees only, and now you're in the back of the business. And things go on in the back that never go on in the front. The same thing works in a restaurant, where the waiter takes your order, smiles, goes into the kitchen, those bastards, what are they, and all that kind of stuff, and the clerk and the cook says, we don't have you got to go back and tell them we don't have it anymore. And all this kind of stuff goes on. You see cartons and crates and, maybe water on the floor. And it doesn't look like the front of the store. And what he's saying is we live our lives this way. How many of you, when you get off work, park your car, open your door, just close it and go, you don't have to be on, right? You get your jammies, you get in your slippers, take off that tie. That's the back of your life, according to him. Interesting read. Very interesting read. So before we dive into the part where we really understand what secret keeping is and how it works, let's be clear. Privacy is perfectly legitimate. We have a right to privacy in this country. So what that means is when you walk through the door of your house and it closes behind you, virtually anything you do is private, okay? And it's nobody's business. It's just you being you. Is there anything bad going on? No. Just getting dinner ready, maybe clicking on the TV. There's nothing really wrong with any of that. It's just you need privacy, though. Okay? So privacy is perfectly okay. Now, secrecy. Let's say that you enter your house, you know, get in your jammies and your slippers, and you make yourself some supper, and you go, wow, I wonder if I have enough money to blah, 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 whatever it is. So you go where? You go to a place that's secret, turn the key, open the door. My goodness, the savings bonds, the, you know, whatever you keep in there that's precious, it's still there. So now you can, you know. So in other words, there's a time when you even in your own home keep things secret. My mother used to have sterling silver. She's gone now. But the point there is that she would hide it so that if anybody broke in the house, they wouldn't be able to find it. She was keeping it in her secret place. Is there anything wrong with that? No, it's perfectly okay. So, I like this one by Ben Franklin. He was a clever dude, wasn't he? Yeah. So, we all keep secrets, that we know that. They're essential to our privacy, and here are some of them. You vote by secret ballot. That's a secret. Pregnant women, during the first few weeks of pregnancy, often keep things a secret until they know the right person at the right time to tell, you know. And a surprise birthday party. Surprise! You're 50 years old. Down the hill. So, what are secret keepers? People who intentionally, on purpose, keep their addictive or shameful habits secret from everyone, and they get away with it. Is that the rest of the slide? Oh, the rest of the slide. Until they blow their cover or get caught. And then everything falls apart. Let's see here. I know I can do this. Let's try that. There we go. All better? Okay. So this is the greatest fear that a secret keeper has. Now, let's do some, I've done some research on this. In fact, I did 6 years of research on it. And the result of that was a talk like this and this book right here, Secret Keeping. Highly researched, but very readable. And I'm not selling the book, I'm just saying the research here that's just the tip of the iceberg is detailed and documented here. So, about 1 in 12 of the United States population has secret-keeping issues. They do this stuff. 1 in 12. And, of course, we only know the ones that get caught, right? Or the ones that blow their cover. That's about 8 people per 100. About 4 to 6 of every 12 chemical dependency clients have secret-keeping issues. All of these are estimates. That's about 30 to 35 clients per 100. So that's a good third. So when I was doing active counseling, outpatient, inpatient, didn't matter. If I had, you know, my 100th client, and I went, oh, yeah, look at that, I've done 100 clients now, I could pretty much go back and say a third of those have secret-keeping issues that I wasn't able to discover, that they didn't disclose, et cetera. I do have a story about that. I think in the interest of time, if we have time for that, ask somebody ask me what that story is, and I'll tell you it happened right here in Hazleton. Secret keepers may resist treatment if they prefer to relapse rather than give up, you know, their habits. And yet, it's due to the fear of their secrets or the dishonesty being discovered, and here we go again. It can be a source of pride for them to know all this. And they become their own great hero. So, we're back to this. When secrets are unhealthy, when they cover up our wrongs and misdeeds, when they in our conscience now, we know that we're guilty, we know we feel remorseful, we feel blame and shame when we do nasty and hurtful things on the sly. It splits a person in two, part hidden, part public, and it means living a harmful life. So here's where I'd like you to take out your booklets, the little pamphlets that you got today. And everybody, let's see, Mark, did you? Yeah. This is what I'd like you to do. On the very back page, here's your booklet. This is the interactive part of the talk. This is where you get to answer these eight questions. Now, I'm going to take a little risk here and have you do it right now. If you don't have a pen, if you can't make the markings, if somebody's sitting next to you and you don't want to have them know the answers, then at least do it mentally, all right? And while you do that, I think I'll just be quiet. I'll skip through here. Please note, this informal assessment tool is meant to help you identify your habits, behaviors, and tendencies so you can gain insights that lead to new choices and enlightened decisions. So you have 1 through 4, 8 questions.
I don't have the paper.
I hope there's a few extra.
Thank you.
You're welcome. May need it back, but no, I don't think it will. No. There's someone going to get more of these booklets. Is anybody brave enough to let me see their answers? Yeah? Okay. Come on down. That's a good, solid answer. A good, solid. Yeah. Interesting. Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
We ran out of copies.
Oh, you did.
And they're going to make some more right now.
Okay.
Are you able to put them on the screen?
Sure. Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, it's fine. Okay. 30 more seconds for anybody who needs it. Thank you for the brave ones who showed me their papers. All right. Now, because this is an unscientific assessment tool, I'll give you an unscientific scoring quiz, or scoring rating. What is that called? I would say anyone, I think in terms of, there's a total of 32 points, 5 or somewhere in that range, 6, 7, you're just, you know, like everybody. Everybody has something, and it's nothing really dangerous. Over 10, and you start to think, well, there's something there. And I better look at that question again that I scored a 3 or 4 and look at that more closely as part of, and this is, I recommend this as part of your step 4. I don't know how many of you have done, you know, you can do a step 4 over if you want. we're always re-examining ourselves, our motives, and so on, correct? Yeah. So anything over 10 is like, take a look at a couple of those answers and see what they're telling you. After 15, you're starting to approach what I'm talking about today. You get about half your answers are indicative of what we've talked about so far. Over 20, and over 25, you better look real close, because you're doing something that will probably, let's just say it's in the unhealthy range. So that, and being healthy people in recovery, we want to look at that and address it. Okay. Now, this is the chart we've been waiting to get to. There are really four, this is a continuum. You know, this is the least, that's the most. And this is a continuum of the kinds of secrets. And you have this in your handout as well. Would you please turn to it? I think it's the page before your quiz. You should. Nope, it's not that one. There it is. It's that one. Here, could you let me see? It's this one. It's this page, and it's right after this illustration. Okay. Now, let's be clear. Everybody has what I call simple secrets and silent secrets. I'm going to go through. Instead of general, I'm going to go through what I think could be a good case example. Let's say that a person starts at age 5, 6, 7, or 8 saying to his or her friends, hey, I'll bet so-and-so wins at American Idol tonight. Or I bet such-and-such team will beat the other team. I bet, it happens. People do this. It's very benign. Nothing's really wrong with it. You might bet a dollar, bet a couple dollars, something like that. You might have to do with a video game, because video games can be addicting. And I'll bet you can't do, I bet you can't hold yourself to 2 hours today. You'll go over or something like that. Anyway, people make bets of all kinds. Nothing's wrong with it. Now, let's say the same person had some luck with those wagers and thought, I wonder I ever could win the lottery. Win the lottery. Wow, wasn't that big? Now we've moved into a wish, into a fantasy. And this person is starting to go, well, I can't win the lottery. And think of all the good things until I buy a ticket. As soon as that person moves over with the idea that the lottery is going to make their life and make all the difference they possibly can, it's not just the wager, it's life-changing. They move across the line into secret keeping. Now, they're not going to tell anybody they're doing this. Oh, no. So, they buy a lottery ticket, nothing. They go, all of a sudden, their behavior starts changing. They're buying lottery tickets here and there. Let's see if I got 10 bucks for another. Yep, I got 10 bucks there. And they're starting to spend more and more money, and guess what? They lose every time. Okay, well, one of these days, the more I put in, the more I'm going to get back. So they keep buying, and now the wife or someone in their family might say, hey, do you have that $10 I gave you this morning for, I need to go out and, oh, no, I don't. I spent it on lunch. Right there, a lie. Okay, keeping it secret. If this person really thinks, as the lottery bills and bills and bills, and they advertise this, then at some point, that person might, as I would call, lose it. For example, they might say, you know, if I bought 500 tickets, and they have a system, right? They have a way of figuring this out so they can beat the system. Okay, well, you know, that kind of money, though, my employer. Well, now they start stealing from their employer because they don't have any money in their own personal account. They start to embezzle. We see this in the newspaper all the time. County worker arrested, stole $83,000 from, the department, the company. We see this, and, we see it with women, we see it with men. So what has happened here is we've gone from a benign, childish, childlike situation to a fantasy and wish fulfillment to acting out, spending money, calculating the odds, to actually stealing money from somebody. Who knows, maybe that person has an elderly mother or father who's got dementia, but there's all that money. We can just skim a little bit. You get the idea. So the secret is never out until something happens. And now, and people, of course, can go to their grave with these secrets never being discovered. So let's look at number three. It leads to acting out. What I call the rituals or stealing hours away from your normal life. What about the guy that got in his disguise, went to a casino, bet, came back? I mean, obviously he stepped out of his normal life. Now here's the key. It triggers self-defeating behaviors. Okay? All of this is something that will defeat you from it. What's one of the important things for people in recovery in 12 steps?
Honesty.
Yes, but this is all dishonest. It's just the two are not compatible. Okay, then it stretches boundaries. So maybe the wife or the kids at home say, you know, you were supposed to be here for dinner an hour ago. Where have you been? Well, I just had a little trouble on the freeway. You know, you can hear the excuses, right? And what clever excuse can I use this time? Because something, you know, it took a little too long, longer than they expected. Whatever the reason is, they are now, actually, it's impinging on the relationship that person has with loved ones, family, friends, and so on. Now, the key here is that secret keeping by itself does not lead to crime. You don't get arrested for it. If you go in and buy 100 lottery tickets at the store, nobody will arrest you. Now, what if a person, we can do a drinking scenario here. What happens if a person gets sloshed, gets in their car, is keeping it a secret, nobody knows they're at the bar, and starts driving? What then? Where are we on this grid? Four. You're doing something illegal called driving while you're drunk. So if it could lead to an arrest, and we've seen many, many drunk drivers arrested. It could, if there's injuries, it could lead to injuries. You're putting the public in danger. If you have kids in the car, have you ever heard the story of somebody who went into a bar, said to his kid, look, it's, you know, 20 below zero, just wait here for a minute. So the kid waits in the car, and an hour and a half later, the kid is freezing, and dad, or whoever, comes back out. That's really impinging on somebody's life, and it happens. Child endangerment. So we can move very quickly into crime if we're drinkers. And I have to confess, I never got a DWI. Don't ask me why. Must have been angels covering for me. But I know I drove home drunk at least 100 times over the course of some 30 years. Thank you that I never got caught. So I'm on this grid myself. Now, what we want to do in our recovery and what we're going to look at how to do is if we're doing this stuff, we want to go backwards, as it were. Your challenge is to go back to healthy living, where you disclose secrets, return to healthy living. Generally, disclosing secrets to somebody. Now, this could be a cab driver who's giving you a ride home. Did you know that? It could be that. And why would somebody do that to a cab driver? That cab driver is a stranger. They'll never see or hear from this person again. So he can spill all the beans, she can spill all the beans that is necessary. Okay, so that's a really safe person to talk to about your ugly secrets. All right. Eventually, though, there's a thing called step five. Admitted to ourselves. Go ahead.
Exactly.
than the exact nature of our wrongs, the exact nature of our secrets. So to do an honest program, these secrets have to be told. Now, the person who's listening in a fifth step situation is doing so knowing and vowing that they will keep this confidential, that this won't go any farther than the room you're in, et cetera, et cetera. And even there, it might be a good idea to pick somebody who is more of a stranger to you than somebody who is at your local church or synagogue or wherever. But in any case, fifth step is where this stuff has to come out. Now, of course, the challenge is I've been doing all this. It's habitual. I've been getting all those exciting things. I've been, you know, the excitement, what were the things that I mentioned? I forgot them all, right? But there's all these emotions that go with it. Now I'm saying no to that. That's a loss. Or it could be. So here's what happens. You're acting one way, but you're feeling another. So your outside is not matching your inside. You're placing your appearances first, as in the sense of, something management, impression management. You're trying to impress people in a certain way. Reality, though, is way different. You're stealing hours to do guilty pleasures. Why? To feel those emotions we looked at. To fill up something that's missing or wrong inside you. You know, the big book says on page 64, resentments are the number one offender. Kills or destroys more alcoholics than anything else is the root of all spiritual disease. So I was burning with resentments in my active period of being a secret keeper. And so when I got to my fourth and fifth step, I had to really say, here's why I'm resentful. Here's what it means to let those go. Here's how I'm going to, you know, lead a life that does not lead or that dismantles those resentments and doesn't create more. So it's like walking a tightrope. You know, you're in two different worlds and you've got to walk this tightrope. Yeah, pretty soon you're going to fall off. So sometimes secret keepers confuse intensity for intimacy. If it's intense enough, then I feel like I'm a living a bit. But there's nothing intimate about it. Leads to escape actions. You can read this for yourselves. How's this for addictive thinking? If it's worth doing, it's worth doing to excess. When indulging secretly in habits that relieve tension, for the moment, they tend to relieve tension. They escape the pain of real life by chasing false pleasures. Eventually, of course, tolerance builds up, and you have to go bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger until there's a fall. So this is kind of a review here. This is a good time to mention this book. This is called The Addictive Personality by Craig Nochen. Anybody have ever seen this book? It's a Hazelden book, and it is a gem. It talks about what we're going to, about that word right there, warfare. There is a war going on in our when we're addicted, actively addicted. As it builds and builds and builds, we want one thing. How many people wanted to stop but thought they couldn't stop? I was one. I thought, I can't stop. I'm hooked. Well, how many people have you heard that smoke cigarettes say, I want to quit? A lot of them. I have a friend right now. He's a sponsee. He would love to quit smoking. He knows that those cigarettes, you know, he doesn't stop. He just simply doesn't stop. He's resigned to smoking the rest of his life. He wants to quit. Now, that's warfare. He wants something, but he's doing something else. He wants something, he's doing something else. It just goes back and forth like this. Okay, so how do we break free? Tips, tools, and techniques. First, there's the motivation to change. Realize that you are, or maybe in the past now, that you were heavily invested in the secret keeping stuff, and recognize that your worst fear was being exposed. Well, that ends at your step five. Paint an accurate picture of what and who has been squandered or slighted, the time that you've stolen away from people, the self-esteem, and so on. These are steps 4 and 8. Because 8 is what? Made a list of all the people we had harmed. Mm-hmm. So, doing this is a good start. Because your only two options are to change to a freer way of life that is hot, honest, open, and transparent. Or continue on your path at the risk of harming yourself and harming others and making things worse. So here's a way to look at this. There's external pressures. Many times people say, well, I had to come to treatment. You know, I was in trouble with the laws, and my wife was going to maybe divorce me. You know, my employer was going to fire me. Those are external pressures. And they can be useful for motivation, at least the startup. So what are you doing by all this addictive behavior? You're impairing your health. You're putting your job in jeopardy. There's threats from your family about what they have to, they're fed up and have to do something. You've said, I'm sorry, too often. Basically, in any game, does defense win the game? I want to ask that question. This is all playing defense. No, it can't stop the other team from winning. But if the score is 0-0, nobody wins until somebody puts points on the board, and that means offense. So there's times when you're forced to change, just go with it. And there's times when you choose to change, and that's empowering yourself, and now you can say, wow, I can be promoted at work. I've got new choices. I can keep my promises now that I was always breaking. I can gain what is better if I use internal motivators. But both work together. Right? Yeah. So, one thing to do is to change your self-talk. Now, think of the self-talk here. I'm a loser. I'll never be anybody. I'm incapable, undeserving. I don't matter. Life is out to get me. There's this booklet that did wonders for me. It's called It's Not As Bad As You Think. It's a booklet. I'm really not selling Hazelden books here. but it is a Hazelden booklet. You see, when I was here as an intern and hired on as a counselor, I had many of these issues still active. I mean, I made lots of strides in the right direction, but I wasn't done. So this really, really helps. It talks about the ABCs of change. And what the premise of this is, see if I can get to it here. People are not upset by things. That's the premise here. But by their thinking about those things. So the idea here is that something happens and you think of it in a certain way. And that gets you upset because you've judged it. You see it as negative, you think it's wrong, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there's a way to change your thinking about the same event and not be upset. Because what do people do when they're upset? They use, they drink, they go back, they relapse. Check it out. Really good. A guy named Jack Hafner wrote it. It's excellent. So, you can change, I'm a loser to, I'm a winner. And you go, oh no, I'm not a winner. Well, just say it to yourself. Just say it. I'm a winner. Say it 10 times a day. Say it 20 times the next day. Just keep repeating, I am a winner. That will take the emphasis on loser and shift it gradually to a positive. And then you can start, well, I'll give you the one example from my, you can see all that. You can read it for yourself. As I did my fourth step, I did a very thorough fourth step because I knew I was in deep trouble. And there's one phrase that kept showing up on all the different things that I, as I looked at my history, and that was, I felt cheated. I felt cheated in so many ways as a child. I felt cheated in school. I felt, pretty soon I kept seeing this word. I felt, I deserved better, but I felt cheated. And I remember thinking, wow, that's no way to live. If you think that every new situation you go into, you're going to get cheated, well, that's a reason to drink. It's a reason to feel bad for yourself. To, you know, self-pity is one of the worst things we can fall into. And I was deep in it. So I thought, what is the very opposite of life cheats me? Boing! Life blesses me. I said, well, I don't feel that way, but what if I believed it? You know, what if I just kept saying, life blesses me? And I did. And then I started to see the things I could be grateful for. Because my sponsor, about 4 months into my fragile sobriety, said, what are you grateful for, John? And I said, nothing. And he said, no. You've got a lot to be grateful for. Take a little book, one of those little pocket type things with the spiral, and write one thing a day, one, that you're grateful for. I filled up 3 of those books, both sides of the page. And what that did is got me in the habit of looking at what I can be grateful for. And there is so much. I'm an American. I have the rights of an American. I have a home to live in. I have a wife who loves me. I have a family. I have a car. I have gas in the car. I have a wallet. In my wallet, I have credit cards, driver's license, cash, a business card. Let's see, what else? I have my mobility. I can walk. I have my health. I can walk wherever I'm going. I'm not getting hangovers anymore. Those are gone. I'm not having blackouts. I don't know how many blackouts I had, but I'm not having any now. Every morning I wake up and I feel fresh. And I'm not even a morning person. And I can be grateful for how beautiful, look at how beautiful it is out there. How can I miss this? It's beautiful. It's spring. The sky is clear. The sun is shining. There's so many things. Right now, this minute, I can be grateful for. I'm grateful to be here. So, that's a different life than feeling sorry for yourself and feeling you're cheated. It's a big, big difference. And that booklet, plus a few other things, helped me a lot. Oh, by the way, what does this mean? New thoughts generate character growth. Make sure we end on time here. What it means is, when you're sober and choosing it and using the 2 ways to be motivated, you're forced to change it, and you're choosing to change it, and you're changing your self-talk, all of a sudden, you're a different person. Gradually, day by day, day at a time. But I'm a new person today. After 20 years of sobriety, there's just no chance I'm going to drink. None. No chance. And I'm happy about that. I have a better life, much better life. So my character has actually changed. And that's an important thing. So, now you have to decide who you're going to disclose to, because you've made the decision you will. Where are you going to do it? When are you going to do it? And how much are you going to tell? I would start with write a letter to yourself. I'm going to let you just read that for about 30 seconds. It's one of the greatest techniques I've ever seen to help people get a start on this process. There's no reason to hold back because you're the only person who's going to read it. You can put it away and look at it fresh in 2 weeks or so. You don't have to mail it. There's all kinds of things that are benefits from writing a letter to yourself, a comprehensive, detailed letter to yourself. What's the first word in the first step? Admit it. Oh, we. Yes, thank you. Duh. Have you ever noticed, by the way, Have you ever noticed how everything in those steps is we, our, us, not me, my, and I? I love that. Okay, what's the second word in the first step? Admitted. Hey, we do it again. We don't do it once. We do it a lot of times. Now, here's where you can do something on your own. That's the reason for the solo. You want to disclose it to yourself, and that fits step four, a moral, fearless, and searching inventory. Then you do so with your higher power. This is a spiritual program. The 12 steps is a spiritual way of being healthy as sober people. In a community of other people doing the same thing as you, and the whole world is better because of it. So that's something that you... How many people have done a fifth? How many people would even consider doing it again sometime? That's good. That's good. You may not get it all the first time. So then you go down to the safe persons, step five. This is another version of step five. This is clergy, counselors, health professionals, doctors, or even people in your support group or at your AA meeting. I remember doing this very thing with somebody. The meeting had ended, and somebody came up to me and said, John, you are just so, what's wrong with you today? You're just so down. And I told her one of my secrets, and it released me. It relieved me. And then with loved ones, do you notice the ABCD? The loved ones are the ones who have the biggest stake in your life, and you have the biggest stake in their life. So this is where you have to say, I only need to say so much. I don't have to say a whole lot. I just have to indicate sometimes. We can get into details later, but the first time you disclose to your spouse or to somebody, and I recommend no young children, but older children, maybe in high school and above, if you have to. And you can decide to do it at home. You can do it in a safe place. You can do it outside on a hiking trail. You can pick the place where you know you're going to do it. You can have it rehearsed what you're going to say because you've written it down. And you're going to pick certain things from that letter, certain things from your fourth step inventory. And you're going to say, it's time I finally told you this. Don't do it by phone. We've got some do's and don'ts here. Don't do it by email, phone, or letter. Now, the one time you could do it in a letter is if somebody's already dead and you want to make amends to them. That's not unheard of. Or maybe somebody's halfway across the world. But nowadays we have, internet and cable and everything. So the point is to do it in person whenever possible. Speak only in themes. Don't wallow in details. Save the very, very worst for later. Just get the process starting, and don't allow children. And then do those things. Quiet place. Do write out what you need to say. That helps you verbalize it when it's time to talk. And we're going to go to about 3 more minutes. So the result of these kinds of steps, and of course I've had to keep this to 1 hour, the result of this is the hot life. Look at that ladder, huh? Look at that guy, right into the stars. Now, here's how you measure your progress. And that's the other sheet you have there. There's another sheet in your booklet. I don't have a booklet, but yeah, that's it. Could I have it to show? It's this diagram here. Thank you. This is all about the degree of secrecy. And I'll just tell you this because of time. You can read a cross, and that's a very good thing to do. It's like, what is that? Anyway, you can read down the column and see the characteristics of each of these isolated, selfish, sensitive, and recovering. Or you can read a cross. It works both ways. In fact, I recommend doing it both ways. Read across, read down, and you will see some ideas, some tips. And again, this is a place where you've taken the quiz admittedly a very brief quiz, but you could put yourself on this grid where I would like you to, I'm going to ask you to take 30 seconds, look at the grid, and just take a gut reaction. Where do you think you are? Just make a little pencil mark, a little circle or something in this diagram. Obviously, you want to be here, but you may have some business back there, but this is where you want to be. So, there you are, the hot life. Remember, living clean brings rewards. It really, really does. You don't have all the excuses, all the alibis, you don't have it, it's gone. A story? I was going to read a poem too. The story was this. I was a just hired counselor here. I was on one of the women's units. This was way back, so that I don't think anybody will, their anonymity will be protected. And it was that morning slice after. It's the morning slice of 75 minutes before the noon break. And here I am, a man, sitting in a room with eight women. And I'm thinking, wow, am I privileged. I mean, I just felt that way. I really felt privileged to be in this setting because. So I said, I was writing this book at the time, and I said, does anybody here have a secret that you know has impacted your drinking, your using? Can anybody answer that question? And my training at the time said, ask a question and stop talking. So I did. I waited 1 minute, or it seemed like a much longer time, but I waited about a minute. There was complete silence. And then this one voice said, I have a secret. I've had an abortion that nobody knows about. Nobody. And she started to tell what that meant. That she was so tired of carrying the burden. She was so upset with herself about, this had really impacted her life. And so she was telling the other women, I was really only listening. And when she finished, there was a quiet. I said, does anybody else have a secret? Another voice. I've had two abortions, and only one person knows, and that's my boyfriend. And it just eating me up. I want to tell my mom. I wanted to tell. And she went to that story. I thought, wow. My hope at that moment was that by seeing the importance of that secret in their life was opening up the doors to and shining light into their lives, that they could then move forward knowing that's part of their fourth step, that's part of their fifth, it's part of their recovery to disclose this. So I was really excited about the fact of the depth of sharing. And then I waited again, and another person said, I've had an abortion. Three people. And for those three women, they were different people when they walked out of that room. The other women got involved in helping and talking and nurturing and comforting and caring for them. And I just kept kind of backing away. And I remember the bell rang or whatever signal we had in those days. And I remember thinking, that is one of the most profound things I've ever been part of. And I am so grateful. So, in many ways, this book and this whole topic got triggered by, that was one of the triggering things that told me, this is an important topic. So, we're at closing time. I hope you go to your groups and really enjoy getting into your part of this. And what?
If you want to read the poem, we'll be all right.
Read the poem? Okay. I've got three. I'm going to read this one. You probably have heard this, but just think of this in terms of what we've all said now. This is called Autobiography in Five Short Chapters by Portia Nelson. 1. I walk down the street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I fall in. I'm lost. I'm helpless. It isn't my fault. It takes forever to find a way out. 2. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I pretend I don't see it. I fall in again. I can't believe I'm in the same place. Well, but it isn't my fault. It still takes a long time to get out. 3. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. I see it there. I still fall in. It's a habit. My eyes are open. It is my fault. I get out immediately. 4. I walk down the same street. There is a deep hole in the sidewalk. And I walk around it. 5. I walk down a new street. Thank you, everybody.